The content shared on Your Life, Your Wealth Network reflects the views of the host and guests of the program only and are not necessarily the views of Cordasco Financial Network or its advisors. This media production is educational in nature and should not be construed as financial, legal, or tax advice or a solicitation or presentation of sale of any financial products or services. Please consult a professional prior to making any financial, tax, or legal decisions. Welcome to the Your Life, Your Wealth Network. Helping you find clarity and comfort for your life and wealth. Now, here's your host, financial advisor, and CEO of Cordasco Financial Network, Steve Cordasco.
And welcome to the Your Life, Your Wealth Network. I'm Steve Cordasco. So happy you're here and part of the program. As you know, we also broadcast on 990 WNTP each and every Saturday, 10 to 11. You can find me on Facebook, facebook.com/CFN Plan. Lots of good info going out in that direction through our Facebook account. So please go on and friend us. Here's what we got coming your way today. I'm going to discuss retirement and debt, how retiring with debt can be detrimental, what you can do. Unfortunately, more and more people are retiring with debt. Also joining me is Heather Long. We're going to break down the Clinton-Trump debate. She's also going to talk financial literacy. And also, I'm going to talk about a new type of online banking system called the Simple Account. And it's something you should know about if you have kids, loved ones, people that you worry about their spending habits. It's real time, and it'll be interesting for you to hear about this new technology savvy bank. And I'm really excited to talk about the next subject with my guest, Richard Rubin, who is U.S. tax policy writer for The Wall Street Journal. We're going to talk taxes and the presidential debate. Richard, welcome to the show.
Hey, Steve, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much. Okay, so how did Donald Trump present his tax plan the other evening during the first debate?
So what he talked about is there's going to be big league tax cuts, and he's right for the most part. So he would cut the top tax rate on individuals. He would cut tax rates on businesses. He would repeal the estate tax. He would introduce a new deduction for child care. And so for the most part, people are seeing real significant tax cuts from the plan he's proposing.
And Hillary seems to be on the other side of those cuts, but she seems to be getting cute in that she doesn't really talk about cuts, but she throws out these numbers that make things look like, I mean, she's throwing things at the more or for the high income folks and for the wealthy, and it's making it sound like that's going to replace other taxes for the middle class and other classes. Am I onto something there or no?
Sort of. Let me try and unpack that a little bit for you. So here's what she's doing. She's trying, unlike Trump, she's trying sort of very carefully to say, if I propose a tax cut or an increased spending proposal, I'm going to pay for it. I'm going to find new taxes on high-income, high-wealth people to pay for it. And so what she does is she's got some spending programs, so things like guaranteed paid leave, things like she wants to do on infrastructure, things, you know, all sorts of these programs that she's talking about, debt-free college, and she's got some targeted tax cuts, so an increase, though she hasn't offered details yet, in the child tax credit, a tax credit if you're caring for an elderly relative, a tax break for out-of-pocket health care costs. So they're, for the most part, they're really narrow tax cuts that she's proposing, and then she's paying for them with tax increases on high-income people. And there's we can talk about this more, but there's a whole range of things. Basically, if you're in the top 1% or 0.1% and you're making money somehow, she wants to tax more of it.
Well, so here's what gets me, okay? And this has got me in a big way because, you know, I'm big for the middle class. And I would love to see the middle class get help, especially the middle class that actually gets up and goes out and does something, right? They want to be productive. They're not part of the transfer payment system. Let me try to do as little as I can to see how much I can get from other sources. So that brings me to the alternative minimum tax. Now, Donald Trump, and correct me if I'm wrong, says he wants to eliminate the alternative minimum tax, which would be a huge benefit for middle class, right? Might be one of the biggest benefits we've seen in a long time to the middle class.
Yes and no. I think the aim depends on how you define middle class, which is always a fun political debate here in Washington. But, look, the AMT's effect.
Well, let me I don't mean to interrupt, but let's just say you got a school teacher and a nurse. Okay, they're now subject to AMT, right? Because their wages have gone up over time, but AMT has not adjusted as much, right? So they tend to get hit by AMT.
They tend, some extent, to get hit by AMT. The real hit of it is two things. One is the complexity. So even if people in that income bracket, call it, you know, 150 to 200,000 combined, maybe, aren't necessarily paying it, you have to calculate your taxes twice, and
right,
that can
yeah,
be sort
like,
of annoying, right?
Yeah, somebody earning 93,000, and maybe somebody else earning 72,000 in the household. You're flirting in there. You're in there. You're in it.
Yeah, and then, but the real money is from the AMT is actually higher than that. It's people in the $200,000 to $500,000 range who really actually get hit by it. The AMT is sort of strange because it effectively penalizes you for having a large family because you can't get the personal exemptions, and it also penalizes you for, you know, living in a high tax state. So for, you know, listeners who are in New Jersey in particular, like that's one of the states that really gets hit by the AMT.
Yeah, and so Hillary says, I guess she doesn't really say she wants to get rid of AMT for the middle class. She just says, and her language seems to be, and I'm quoting, create a new minimum 30% rate on individuals earning $1 million. So that makes it sound like that's her new benchmark for alternative minimum tax. But correct me if I'm wrong, she's not saying she's eliminating it for those folks that are in that borderline range. And I got to tell you, you're right. It hits the $500,000 individual pretty heavily. But if you take it across the board and proportionately and you know, the hit to that school teacher and nurse or you know, the plumber and secretary type of income person, proportionally, it's just as painful. So this sort of makes it look like alternative minimum tax for Hillary's side is more about the $1 million and over, but she's not really addressing those that have kind of been pushed into this thing that were never intended to be in it.
Right, no, she's not at all talking about repealing the existing AMT. What she's talking about doing is adding a sort of second minimum tax, not on those people, but on people who are making $1-2 million and up. This is what they call the Buffett rule. And so, no, she's gotten, as far as I know, no proposal on dealing with the existing AMT. The AMT exemption or exclusion is linked to inflation now. I mean, for a while it wasn't. Congress has dealt with that, but it still affects millions of people every year, and particularly in high tax states. And so it's certainly an issue. It's one that Republicans talk about repealing all the time, but it brings in a lot of money from those other people, from the $200,000 to $500,000 people. And so that's, I think, one of the reasons you don't hear Democrats, even though it's a lot of Democratic voters who pay it, you don't hear Democrats talking a lot about repealing it because the cost to the budget is pretty significant.
Richard Rubin is my guest. He's a U.S. tax policy writer for The Wall Street Journal, does great work, and you can read The Wall Street Journal online like I do, or if you're old school, do what I do as well. I get the written copy, too. It seems like everybody is comparing Ronald Reagan, something to Ronald Reagan. I recently attended a nice event. I got an invite from Larry Kudlow to go to New York Yacht Club as he presented his book talking about how Ronald Reagan and JFK had very similar economic policies. And, you know, one being a poster of the Democratic Party, the other being the poster of the Republican Party, both well-liked and deep in traditions. Trump seems to connect his plan to Ronald Reagan. How similar are those plans, and is there merit to the idea of trickle-down? As I'm reading this book right now, talking how JFK was all for trickle-down, and it seemed to work, and so was Reagan.
Okay, so let's step back for a second. The marginal tax rate, right, is that top bracket tax rate, those top couple brackets. Back when JFK took office, those rates were around 90. When Reagan took office, those rates were around 70. It applied to very few. They applied to very few people. They, you know, there were all sorts of other ways that people had of avoiding that rate. But marginal rates matter, right? I mean, economists would basically tell you pretty universally that they matter. There's dispute about how much, but they matter. And so when you reduce rates from 90 to 70, from 70 to 50, and then eventually to 28, as the Kennedy-Johnson cuts and the Reagan cuts did in the 60s and 80s, you get some benefit from that. And there, because think about it, think of the things you would do to avoid a 90% tax, you might not do them to avoid a 28 or a 50% tax, as onerous as 50 sounds to us now. So the question for today is, with the top rate of 39.5 and, you know, with some other taxes taxed on top of that, is that benefit still there? Can you get as much benefit from reducing that to 33, as Trump says, as you really could from, you know, from lowering those 90 and 70% rates that were in existence in the 60s and the 80s? And that's sort of the question. And then there's also the trade-off question. Like, you know, would that encourage people at the top to work and save and invest more? Probably. But there's also budgetary considerations, and there's what Clinton calls the sort of fair share considerations about who's paying. And so this is sort of the political judgment that we all have to make as voters is, you know, Trump and Clinton are presenting two very, very different visions of what tax policies should apply to that top 1 to 2% of households.
Yeah, it certainly does. And you know, I just for some reason keep going back to hearing Hillary talk about it takes a village and talking about all these things you need to do to get by in life. I don't know if you remember that speech years and years ago. And yeah. I view it now as I look at this and I say, and just as you said, JFK, we had a 90% federal, right? Reagan, 70. But we didn't have all these other taxes, right? City of Philadelphia, I didn't have that tax. I didn't have a usage tax. I didn't have tax on water. I didn't have city tax. I didn't have state tax. You know, you start to add up all these taxes and, you know, she lets that go and it's bothersome. And I tend to hear a little bit more Donald talking about overtax. Now, on one thing, I will agree. There is one piece so far that I like, unless she's changing. I want some clarity on it. She adds a 4% surtax on income over $5 million.
Yeah.
Now, that's going to rock some of my folks listening. And the only reason I bring it up is I'm a financial advisor, right? So I deal with people, I see their income. And I got to tell you, folks that really get in that range of $5 million of income, that's what we're talking about, income, not total assets. That's income over $5 million. They're giving money away, right? They, at that stage, they, majority of them, are looking for things they can do. Now, you might say them giving it away might be better use than putting it back into the government, but we know that it's very difficult to run the whole operation on its own without taxes. So that's a tax I can swallow. I can stomach that tax. Donald, on the other hand, doesn't really say anything about the bigger income cash flow folks, and I guess maybe because he pays zero, he probably doesn't need to right now.
I mean, we don't know what he pays. Look, I mean, his proposal would allow a 15% rate on business income, and the campaign is sort of a little vague about exactly what falls in that bucket, but you've got a lot of people in exactly that group that you're talking about who would pay a lot less because they get their business income taxed at 15, and then, you know, wages and profits would be taxed sort of separately. Mm-hmm. And so there's a, you know, she really is trying to segment and create a very different tax system for the call them the super rich than for the merely rich, and which I think you're clearly picking up on there. And that's, you know, been a long dispute about how that should work. You know, right now that top tax bracket takes effect somewhere in the mid-400s. And she's saying, wait a minute, there's people who are doing really, really well, and they need to pay their fair share. Again, we can all debate what fair is. But that's sort of what she's saying is that these people at the very, very top, it's hedge fund managers, private equity managers, athletes, actors, business executives, also really successful business owners, right? I mean, and so she's basically saying those people are doing really well and should have to pay more.
Where was she on the carry trade?
On carried interest, she's for repealing that. So he is too, but his plan is, it's hard to tell whether they'd be able to call that business income and pay 15% anyway. But she's sort of long been exactly where President Obama's been.
Do you trust that she'll do that? Because President Obama said he would do it. He didn't do it. And it seems like Hillary, I believe, has taken a lot of checks from Wall Street. So it doesn't seem to be in the forefront. I don't see her barking about it. I don't see her really doing the Bernie Sanders loud noise around it. Is this just something she's going to try to slip through and then, you know, take the Wall Street money and private equity money and not really take care of that those dollars that are sitting there and getting that benefit?
I think the real barrier to that is actually in Congress. I mean, I think Obama would have signed it if Congress had ever sent it to him. I think she'd, I mean, boy, it'd be weird if she didn't sign it if Congress sent it to her. The real barrier has been in Congress. So Republicans have included repeal of carried interest in the bigger tax reform plans they've talked about. Those obviously haven't gone anywhere yet. They're reluctant to use that as sort of a one-off kind of piece to pay for something else. And so that's been where a fair amount of the resistance has come from. And I think you could actually apply that to almost everything she's talking about. So she's got, you know, a couple trillion dollars worth of, like $1.9 trillion worth of tax increases on high-income households over the next decade. Well, the percentage of those that a Republican-controlled House is going to be willing to do is pretty darn small. So that's going to be the real issue as I look forward. You know, say she wins, the real question is how, with a Republican Congress, would the next 4 years be different from the sort of stalemate on this issue that we've seen basically since January of 2013 and the fiscal cliff deal?
All right, I'm going to put you on the hook here, Richard. Final question. Who's got the better tax plan?
Oh, I don't. I make
on.
It a point not to make that judge. Let me say, look, there's because it really it's a value judgment for voters to make. Like, I think they both have relatively clear tax plans, and you know, if you think that we're overtaxed as a country and that the economy would be a lot better if people didn't pay much at the, you know, people who are at the top didn't pay as much, and other people were able to get some breaks too, though some people look like might even pay a little more under Trump's plan. If you think that's the general direction that you want to go, that we're an overtaxed country, and we'd see growth if we cut business and individual tax rates, then you've got a pretty clear choice.
Yep.
If you see what she's talking about, then you got a pretty clear choice in that direction.
Well, Richard Rubin, I got to at least say that Donald Trump has a clear.
Ish.
Clear policy, tax policy. At least he's clear on something. Ish. We'll throw the ish in there. Hey, thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen. Richard Rubin, U.S. tax policy writer for The Wall Street Journal. Check out his work. He's fabulous. And Richard, thank you for joining us here on the Your Life, Your Wealth Network. Appreciate it.
Yep, thanks much.
And ladies and gentlemen, broadcasting on 990 WNTP as well. You can find me on Facebook, facebook.com/CFNplan. You can also email me, steve@cfnplan.com. We'll be back in a moment.
Hi, Hugh Hewitt here. Do you have a sound retirement strategy? Have you taken the time to sit down and write a plan for achieving your retirement dream? Sadly, most of us spend more time planning our vacations than our own financial future. I'm here to tell the Delaware Valley a name that most people probably already know. Steve Cordasco. You've been listening to Steve for the last 25 years. You've been reading his articles in the Philadelphia Business Journal, Forbes, TheStreet.com. Steve Cordasco and his team have just come out with a new guide for retirement planning called Your Plan to a Successful Retirement. Get your copy right now at cfnplan.com. That's cfnplan.com. The guide is packed with helpful tips like how to make a retirement plan work for you, generating cash flow in retirement, tax saving strategies, ways to reduce stock market stress, investment solutions that match your risk, how to bring comfort and clarity to your retirement, much, much more. And now for my Hugh Hewitt listeners, I strongly recommend you get a copy of Steve Cordasco's guide, Your Plan to a Successful Retirement. Get your copy now at cfnplan.com. That's CFN, N as in network, plan.com. Go now to cfnplan.com.
Heather Long, ladies and gentlemen, is our guest here on the Your Life, Your Wealth Network, and she is senior markets and economy writer for CNN. And Heather, so happy to have you join the program. I have been an advocate for financial literacy for almost 30 years. Matter of fact, I worked for CBS doing radio over the years and did some fill-in work at the Wall Street Journal radio program. I had something called the Financial Literacy Series, where we would bring educational events here to the area where people would come out, and we got a lot of students that would come. That kind of spun into me teaching a gen ed course at Temple University as an adjunct professor called Investing for the Future, which is, and even though I'm a Fox Business School grad, I elected to go more in the gen ed area because I wanted to kind of talk financial literacy, not to those that were just business savvy or had a motivation from the side of business, but to talk to a whole cross-section of students that were not just on a path of business to understand what the world of finance was like. Now, it was easy. It's a 4-credit math course. So a lot of students would take it because they're like, okay, this sounds of interest, and it sounds like it's something that even though I'm not good at math, I might be able to get through. And that's really the purpose of the course. But the beauty of it is that we taught budgeting and how you deal with debt and the whole financial topic and language, because it really is like one student raised her hand and says, this is like learning Spanish. There's a whole different lingo, right? So what's the current state of financial literacy in America?
Well, so I wrote a piece for CNN in early September called Sex Ed is Required, Why Is It Financial Education? And just on an anecdotal level, this was one of the pieces I got the most emails, calls, and tweets about in response. This overwhelming number of people writing and tweeting and saying, I wish I had learned more in school. I don't know why they're not teaching my kids this or my neighbor this. There seems to be a hunger for this, as you've seen in your own work. Mm-hmm. And so far, just looking at the data, it doesn't seem like we're doing a very good job. Unlike sex ed, which is taught year after year and in public schools, only 17 states currently require any sort of personal financing, one-on-one type class. And usually when the problem is I had something like this in Pennsylvania, but they only teach it once. I think I had it junior year for about a month, and then it's done. Whereas you think about something like sex ed, and it's taught year after year after year. So even if you don't have a great lesson or a teacher 1 year, they'll hit it again next year. And so it's really ingrained as important for students. Whereas money education, if you're lucky and it is even offered at your school, it probably isn't offered for a very long time or very in-depth.
That's for sure, and that's what caught my attention in the article. It was maybe it had the word sex in it. I doubt it. I looked at it because I have five kids, and I'm, they're taking sex ed in school. And then there was a parallel to what I do, and you kind of wove in and out of the article extremely well. So I thought, here we go. I need to talk to you in person because you have a way of taking a subject that people would normally gravitate away from, and that is, financial literacy and pulling them into it. What are kids currently learning in school today about finance, if anything?
Again, it varies from school to school. I was happy to see I had a few teachers write to me after this article came out, and they said, hey, I do teach this. I go out of my way to create my own curriculum. But usually when they teach it, as you said, there's so much to know about finance, much like other parts of life, including sex. And with finance, a lot of times they'll do this exercise where they'll have kids, it used to be look in the newspaper, now you look online at websites, try to find a pretend job. So look for the salary, how many, is it $10 an hour, is it $20 an hour, whatever, and then create a budget. See, could you actually live on that job? I remember back in the 90s when I did this, I think I jokingly said I would get a job at the local post office, which paid, $10 an hour. Mm-hmm. And then you'd sort of create a budget. And again, that's kind of 101, very basic personal finance. But we didn't go any further than that. We didn't talk about credit cards. We didn't talk about student debt. Most teenagers, or if they're thinking about college, are very quickly going to have to come to terms with how much debt should I take on? Where should I go to get this debt? And that's not being taught by and large in most schools in America today.
It's not. And what used to aggravate me, if you go back maybe 10 years, because this is when this thing was, I think, a little bit more popular, and I used to argue with some administrators on it. And I actually got asked to come to a couple different schools to participate in it. And I turned it down, the invitation. And I said, I'm not a believer that the stock market game, which was very popular way of teaching, and it got kind of lumped in with the whole financial literacy thing, was a healthy, first step for many to learn about the world of finance, right?
Yeah.
Because it takes budgeting, and of course they tried to take the gambling aspect out of it versus the investment side. But I thought, boy, we need to do so much more heavy lifting before we get to a packaged program like the stock market game. Any thoughts on that?
I think you're exactly right. And I think the other part, and I've written about that, they do this in college too. Some groups like TD Ameritrade will sponsor these short-term stock market trading games for maybe 6 weeks or a semester. And again, it's not bad, but you think about when I wrote a piece last year about one of the college teams that won one of those contests. And of course, Well, they even said to me, they said, we did something we would never do in real life in order to win this game. And that was, you know, they used a lot of speculative bets that stocks would rise and fall. They started to short stocks and play around with derivatives. And again, most regular people are not going to do that and probably shouldn't be doing that, certainly not with their retirement portfolio. So I think you're right. Those games, they mean well, but they aren't actually teaching the vast majority of people the real basics of diversify your portfolio. Invest in low-cost index funds by and large. So those common principles that are preached over and over again are not emphasized in that kind of a game or a strategy.
So schools seem to be failing in the area of teaching financial literacy. What can we do?
Obviously, I was trying to get the conversation going again. I think you sounds like you've tried to do it over and over again as well. I mean, honestly, I know I also heard from some teachers who said, look, I think this is a great idea, but it's just one more regulation if you put it on K-12 schools. Mm-hmm. But I just go back to where else are people going to learn it? If you look at tests, every now and then they do these tests of financial literacy. You know, can kids answer basic questions about interest or debt and loans? And, you know, over and over again, the results show rich kids are much better prepared than poor kids. And so, you know, on a lot of levels in America, financial education, if it's happening anywhere, is only happening at home. And it just seems to me that we're going to exacerbate inequality, exacerbate the differences between haves and have-nots if we don't teach this in somewhere in K-12 education in our public schools. I just don't see where else it's going to get to kids, particularly in middle class and lower income kids.
So maybe this is one reason why I guess Trump is saying let's wipe out the Department of Education, because they don't seem like they know what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, education is complicated. I think a lot of people sort of throw up their hands. In Pennsylvania, I mean, I grew up there, as we know, it's really run at the local level, these local school boards, and about 500 of them. And so that makes it tricky, too, because one school district could be doing a good job, and right next door, they could be doing a very poor job. So, and there's a debate. It's kind of like Common Core. Should we have national standards for this? Or should we have a national curriculum around this? I don't know. That's getting a little dicey, but I certainly think that more schools should make it a priority to teach this.
Well, let's really go to the wallet then, right? Because money talks from the local level all the way up the political ladder. So does the lack of financial literacy impact the economy? Are there studies on that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know that I've seen direct studies on it, but I think we can certainly see that people are not making smart choices with their money. In my article, I highlighted the kind of stunning statistic that just came out earlier this year from the Federal Reserve, that when you ask people, would you have enough money saved to cover a $400 emergency expense? So, you know, something happening with your car or an unexpected medical expense. I mean, $400, you know, that happens to a lot of us throughout life. And nearly half of the people in this country don't even have, said they couldn't, they wouldn't be able to cover that. They don't even have that basic savings. You can look at the credit card debt problems we have in the country, or you can look at the student loan debt that we have, or certainly the retirement crisis. Mm-hmm. Not enough people saving for when their 401k or their IRAs. So if you look at kind of the evidence around how people are actually doing with their money, it's appallingly bad in this country. So that to me, you know, is it a huge drag on the economy? Well, it's hard to say, because if people aren't saving, they're probably spending. So that may be helping the economy, but certainly it's not helping them in the long term.
You want to play a little fantasy with me?
Sure.
All right. If you had to remove any subject from school for financial literacy, what would it be?
Well, I had this debate with a college professor once. This may be a little controversial, but we were decided that I'm not sure trigonometry is the most useful useful subject long term. And I love math. I think math, you know, certainly by and large should be a very fundamental part of the education. But And when I look back, I'm not sure that I have ever used trigonometry, whereas I have used everyday statistics.
or sex ed?
Right. And so I wonder if...
I thought you were going to tell me sex ed, by the way, just to let you know.
That seems pretty important, too.
Well, you titled the article, so I thought, you know, I'd weave you back there at some point. Anyway, hey, has there been any mention of it during the presidential campaign? I know you've been watching the campaign closely. Has it come up, or is it just been lost in all the other noise and rhetoric?
Well, I think here is how I think it's come up. And I've seen this. I've just been in Florida, Pennsylvania, and Ohio talking to voters. And I know, obviously, Trump and Clinton and even Gary Johnson and Jill Stein and Bernie Sanders. You know, everyone can sense and is hearing what I call this economic anxiety. I mean, I even talk to people who have jobs, who are doing pretty well. You might even consider them middle class, upper middle class. They've got a nice home, and they are worried. They are worried whether they're worried about the debt or whether they're worried about how they're going to pay for their kids' education and college, or whether they're worried if they're going to lose their job. They sort of have this fear of what's going on, even if they're doing okay right now. They're worried they're not going to get by. And I think that really goes to the heart of both, you know, the bigger problems in the economy, but also the day-to-day reality of people not feeling that they understand their finances well enough and that they're able to do what they want to do with them.
What have you learned? And we'll shift gears now, because I know you've been watching the campaign closely. You're there at CNN. Ladies and gentlemen, Heather Long is senior market and economy writer for CNN. What have you learned about Trump and Hillary's economic policies during the debate the other night?
I mean, on a basic level, and I actually thought that first 20 minutes to 30 minutes, in my mind, was some of the more best part of the debate when it kicked off and they were really focused on jobs and on the economy. And, certainly it's really the two very, very different visions of where to go. You know, Trump wants a big tax cut, a lot like the Reagan era. People keep using this term trickle-down economics or supply-side economics. His basic argument is, look, I'm going to cut taxes on people in business. That's going to put more money in people's pockets, and that's going to stimulate the economy. You know, we can have a debate till the cows come home on whether that's going to work or not, but that's really his philosophy. And then on top of that, he layers in he's going to renegotiate these trade deals and maybe bring the jobs back. Again, most people don't think that would happen. Even when I'm out in Pennsylvania and Ohio talking to manufacturing workers, they say, look, I wish my jobs would come back or the jobs of my neighbors. I like what Trump's saying. I think trade's a problem, but they're not convinced that he has any magic solution to bring those jobs back.
No, it's interesting, you know, though, and they're still willing to vote for him, which is good.
Yeah. Because I think that, you know, that goes to the other side. Hillary Clinton's plan is really more classic, what we call Keynesian economics, and that notion that we're going to have the government spend more, we're going to tax the rich, and then basically it's redistribution, and the government will fund various programs to help the middle class and the lower class, and that will help boost the economy. So that's more her vision. You know, there's a big debate about, will anything boost the American economy back to what it once was, right? So we really got hurt in the Great Recession and the financial crisis. We have not been growing nearly as fast as we used to. And wages have certainly not been growing very fast in the last few years. And so, I think there's a big debate. Can anything really bring back those glory days?
Heather Long, last volley to you. And since you do write about the markets, everybody seems to be asking, what kind of reaction do you see from the markets based on which candidate wins?
Yep. I wrote a piece on Monday. At the moment, basically, to sum it up, if Trump wins or does well, you would expect the market to tank. Now, whether it'll be like a Brexit, a short-term tank or not, that's up for debate. But the reality is Wall Street is definitely pricing in a Hillary Clinton victory. Now, it's a Hillary Clinton victory, and they also hope for a Republican, you know, Paul Ryan to stay as a Republican House. So basically, we're going to have more, more divided government to keep each other in check. But if that changes dramatically and we start to see Trump do better in the polls or really come out strong in the second or third debate and look like he has a better chance of winning this, I think you're going to see a lot more anxiety in the stock market.
Great. Hey, Heather Long, thank you. You've been a fantastic guest, and I enjoy the work you do at CNN Money. And ladies and gentlemen, Heather Long is senior market and economy writer for CNN Money. Heather, thanks so much. You have a great day.
You too. Bye now.
I'm Steve Cordasco. You're listening to the Your Life, Your Wealth Network. I'll be back in just a moment.
Hey, Rich Dilley here. My friend Steve Cordasco, financial advisor and founder of Cordasco Financial Network, is back with a new retirement guide called Your Plan to a Successful Retirement. This guide is packed with helpful tips like how to make a retirement plan work for you, how to successfully generate cash flow in retirement, and how to utilize great tax savings strategies. This guide also uncovers the best practices to reduce stock market stress, how to find investment solutions that match your risk tolerance, and how to bring comfort and clarity to your retirement. Whether you are taking the first steps to retirement planning and don't know where to start, are in pre-retirement and looking to accumulate wealth, or already retired and looking to preserve your wealth, you should get a copy of Steve Cordasco's guide, Your Plan to a Successful Retirement. And it's totally free. Get your copy right now at cfnplan.com. That's CFN, and as in network, plan.com. Go right now to cfnplan.com.
And welcome back to the Your Life, Your Wealth Network. I'm Steve Cordasco. Topic that I want to share with you now is retiring with debt. More and more people today who are reaching the age between 60 and 65 years who are focused on retiring are retiring with more debt than past generations who have retired. And what's bringing it to the forefront is a new study out by BMO Wealth Management. BMO is Bank of Montreal, Canadian bank, and they found that one-third of Americans say reducing debt or eliminating debt is their number one financial priority. Yet, among baby boomers, where 35% selected reducing debt as their number one priority, we're finding through other studies like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, they say that homeowners who are 65 and older with mortgage debt, they have seen mortgage debt increase from 22% in 2001 up to 30% recently. So there's a trend out there where we're seeing more and more folks in their retired years taking on more debt. And those that are getting close to retirement or newly retired are retiring with more debt than the generation before them. For homeowners 75 and older, we're seeing that rate as well go up. It doubled from 8.4% to 21%. That's a huge jump for those age 75 and older. Yet, the current group of retirees who are retiring seem to have more debt than ever before. So we want to get in and talk about why that is and what's the reason for the debt. Is the primary reason or the main source of debt? Is the main source of debt housing? Is the main source of debt a result of low interest rates? Is the source of debt credit cards? Now, the CBBP says that mortgage debt, which is the largest debt that older consumers carry, they say that's the key driver to the trend. And for many, roughly 4.4 million retired homeowners with mortgage debt, making the monthly payment is a top priority on their monthly expense and can be a hardship. So bottom line is, it looks as if shelter, housing, is the primary debt source. So we're going to dig into this, talk about whether it's healthy or not, talk about as folks retire, what makes good sense, what is not good sense when it comes to financial budgeting, and how do you go about into retirement managing debt? Because it seems as if the debt trend is growing amongst those that are not working or working less. And that can be a dangerous sort of perfect storm to financial catastrophe. So let's dig into it. The current generation of retirees are a different breed than past retirees. I look at it as they've accepted debt through their lifetime. So if you think about it, if someone is age, 65 now, retiring this week, there's a good chance that they've already made their debt habits. They've used debt very differently than someone who might be 85 years of age today who retired 20 years ago. That particular generation of retiree was not hooked on debt, I guess, for a better or lack of a better way to put it. They weren't brought up where using debt became habit. So think about it. Has it become habit to use debt? Think about where you are, regardless of whether you're in the 65 plus bracket, maybe you're in the 55 plus bracket. More so, debt has become more of a habit to you than somebody in the 65 range. What do I mean by that? The internet. One particular now new way of which we're able to shop. Millennials are going to say, what are you talking about, a new way? Well, think about it. In the lifetime of somebody who is 55 or 65 years of age, the internet didn't exist when you were born. You might have gone halfway through your life before you ever did a transaction over the net or on Amazon. But good luck trying to do a transaction and get good pricing without using plastic, without using debt, which is what a credit card is. Has anybody out there maybe bought a home with no debt? Very few have had that opportunity to do it. But the 85 age generation made it a huge priority to try to get that debt paid off as soon as possible. What I found is over the years, different generations, and specifically that 55-year-old to 65-year-old generation that might be thinking about retirement around the corner, or how about that 65-year-old generation today, right, that is about to retire. When purchasing a home or a mortgage, many have gone to the limit. You go and find what you can afford, and you figure out what the max is. And that's the direction you go. Past generations did not use debt in the same way, is what I'm getting at. So if you think about it, a 65-year-old is more likely, as I said, to use credit cards actively, take on big mortgage debt. And how about this? They've experienced education debt. It's hard for me to find an 85-year-old today that has experienced the type of education debt that a 55 to 65-year-old has experienced. So debt is something that has evolved generationally. This is where a lot of anxiety, I believe, comes in when it comes to talking about big banks and financial service companies. Because debt can become a habit. It can become like crack or a drug. You have to have it. When you have a habit, get what we want when we want it, have to have it now. And when you go into retirement and you no longer have that career that's paying you, I'm not talking about a job or a gig, right? We've covered the gig economy here on the show. We've talked about people grabbing a job here and there who are in retirement. But it's that career that generated tremendous cash flow for many to give them the point to be able to retire. Well, it's that tremendous cash flow that was able to pay off that debt. And then when you go into retirement, that cash flow is not there any longer. And cash flow comes from other sources. Here's what's alarming. That 75-year-old that has taken on more debt, more than ever before, has gone from 8.4% to 21%, more than doubled their debt, the 75-year-old. Much of that has come on the heels of low investment returns and trying to get by. Much of that debt is borrowed against the home. Much of that debt has been taken to help other loved ones. So the habit of debt needs to be put into check as retirement gets closer, because you don't know what happens in retirement. That 75-year-old who, when they retired 10 years ago and were heavily thinking about retirement 15 years ago, were not working within a zero interest rate environment. So something to think about. In conclusion, here's strategies that should be looked at, jotted down, and noted as you do your planning, whether you're pre-retiree or post-retiree. And that is the first and foremost thing you need to know. Debt equals stress. That stress increases when the payment system to pay off debt changes. You lose a job. you take a pay cut. You're not working as much. Or think about in retirement. When you no longer have that career path, you've given it up to be able to do what others around you are doing, and that's called retire. And we know nobody today at age 62 to 65, very few, just flat out kick back and say, I'm done. They work side gig jobs to be able to have a little extra cash flow. But when you work within a low interest rate environment and you have debt, that's when the stress elevates. We spoke to a CNN reporter who was in the burbs of Philadelphia interviewing after the debate the other evening, talking about a Muslim man who says, you know what, finances are hurting. I know Trump says certain things about me, but I'm going to vote for him because I feel as if I might have more opportunity from a work standpoint, cash flow standpoint. It goes back to that adage I said, sticks and stones may break my bones, but please don't touch my wallet. And people are very concerned today about their wallet. And I'm not so sure Trump did a good job touching on that, getting into that emotional connection that many today have anxiety over. And I've said this before, where we talk about slavery and freedom and where we are today. I don't care if you're white, black, yellow, brown, Muslim, Jewish, Christian, atheist, where you fall, debt enslaves people of all colors and of race. And we've never had more slavery in this country than we have today. As I pause to let that sink in, because many would say that that comment doesn't do justice to those who had ancestors who were actually slaves. But today is a different country with a different generational makeup. And I say generational makeup. We're not talking color. We're not talking our religious beliefs. We're not talking of being racist. We're talking about what society has become, at least this generation today. And this generation of retirees going into retirement have used debt, have touched debt, and now have decisions to make around it. Because when you have debt, you are enslaved to have to do something you may want to do, and that's work or a certain type of work to be able to pay the big man, whether it's your bank, whether it's a university, whether it's a credit card company. Now, debt is obviously bad if it can't be paid in a crisis. Debt is okay if it's manageable and does not control you. That's called smart debt. And I would argue that there are some 75-year-olds out there that I have probably advised that it's okay to take a mortgage, to give yourself maybe some type of deduction on a tax side. But nobody in their right minds that has any financial savvy would tell somebody who is borderline of being able to pay that debt off in whole to go into debt. The only time in retirement it makes sense to go into debt for a mortgage or anything else is if it can be paid for. And one of the big alarm bells that I'm seeing today is that many retirees, grandparents, want to pay little Johnny and little Sally school debt, their college debt. Why? Because they want to see satisfaction today and not leave something behind where they don't get to see it and witness it, and hence they're willing to pay for it. Some are doing it with debt, and that's not good, unless you can pay it off. So there you go. There's the story on debt, the good side and the bad side. Know where you are as you start to move, your train moves along the track towards retirement. If you're there, newly retired, you might want to consider getting it under control, meaning not the debt you have, but the addiction you might have to debt. And it may not be you who's listening. It might be your other half. And you have to come to terms on that and how you deal with watching QVC, where they have your credit card and it's an easy order, or Amazon Prime, or the checkout line at the supermarket. How are you managing it as you start to end the gravy train of income from a career path into retirement, as then you pick up maybe part of being involved in the gig society that's out there, or working side jobs? Pay special close attention to your debt, and not just your debt, but an internal check of looking in the mirror and finding out whether you have an addiction to debt or not, and whether you can control it or not. If not, get help. There are many out there who will try to help you put it all in perspective. I'm Steve Cardasco. It's the Your Life, Your Wealth Network. You can also find us on Facebook, facebook.com/CFNplan. Follow me on Twitter at CFNplan. You can also email me, steve@CFNplan.com. Facebook is the best, though. We put a lot there, a lot of good info, facebook.com/CFNplan. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, Hugh Hewitt here. Do you have a sound retirement strategy? Have you taken the time to sit down and write a plan for achieving your retirement dream? Sadly, most of us spend more time planning our vacations than our own financial future. I'm here to tell the Delaware Valley a name that most people probably already know. Steve Cardasco. You've been listening to Steve for the last 25 years. You've been reading his articles in the Philadelphia Business Journal, Forbes, TheStreet.com. Steve Cardasco and his team have just come out with a new guide for retirement planning called Your Plan to a Successful Retirement. Get your copy right now at cfnplan.com. That's cfnplan.com. The guide is packed with helpful tips like how to make a retirement plan work for you, generating cash flow in retirement, tax-saving strategies, ways to reduce stock market stress, investment solutions that match your risk, how to bring comfort and clarity to your retirement, much, much more. And now for my Hugh Hewitt listeners, I strongly recommend you get a copy of Steve Cardasco's guide, Your Plan to a Successful Retirement. Get your copy now at cfnplan.com. That's CFN, N as in network, plan.com. Go now to cfnplan.com.
And welcome back to the Your Life, Your Wealth Network. I'm Steve Cardasco. As we wind down the program, thanks so much for joining us. I wanted to give you just some stuff that's in the news outside of the political realm. We've covered Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump pretty actively in the program today, talking about their policies and the debate. And we'll continue to do that as we come closer to the election date. But I wanted to shift gears now and talk about just some of the things that might be getting lost in the headlines when it comes to your wallet and your money. And this one has to do with online banking. And there's an online bank who's called Simple, and they now offer shared accounts for partners, roommates, spouses who have nothing to hide. And this is interesting because you might say, well, geez, my bank, we can have a joint account, you know, and we do have joint accounts. What's the big deal? What this particular online bank, Simple, is doing is they're sending out notifications when something is spent. So here's what sets this up to be, I think, an interesting story. I don't know if you know this, but a recent survey release found that 1 in 3 couples argue about finances at least once a month. It was a pretty big survey, 1,500 couples, and it was just released this past month. Now, about 70% said that they buy things without telling their partner, and that leads to some of the conflict. So what ultimately happens, if you get to the psychology of somebody who might have a QVC addiction or an Amazon addiction, in my house it tends to be Amazon. And here's what's going on. You make a purchase. Amazon knows your credit card, right? As soon as you go in, you make the purchase, boom, the field's already populated for you. And all you have to do is hit the send button. Now you got Amazon Prime. It's as simple as almost a thumbprint today if you have a smartphone. QVC, I'm telling you, I have more and more people I help with their finances. And as we dig into budgeting and cash flow and things that happen to folks with regards to what they do with their money, QVC is an interesting consumer type of experience. When you call QVC, if it's not your first time calling there, They know who you are. They can tell by the phone coming in. They got your credit card. You just got to tell them what you want. They talk to you like you're very important. That's interesting because I find people in retired years, we're finding there's more and more conflict with spouses in retired years. And that conflict comes regarding spending. Might be spending too much on golf, eating out, might be a shoe habit, giving money to the kids and grandkids, or paying for things for them and not letting the spouse know. All these things come into play in retired years. So what's important here is that eventually those bad habits, as we talked earlier, habits where you don't tell the other person because you don't want the other person to know, because you don't want the conflict, that could be detrimental down the road. And discipline needs to come in order. So one way to create discipline could be through this type of an account. Here's what's different. You might say, well, geez, my TD Bank, it's a joint account. Yeah, but they don't notify you with a little ping to your smartphone as soon as an order goes in. So if you're driving to Wawa to pick up a little bit of ice cream, 8 o'clock at night, coming back because you're going to sit down and break open the half gallon and, you know, enjoy your ice cream for the evening, and then your spouse is over there hitting QVC when you're out the door buying the fake diamond earrings, boom, you're getting notified. So anyway, interesting concept. I'm not so sure that for many who do traditional banking, it'll catch on. And I'm not so sure people that are in conflict with finances would maybe draw the connection that this is one technique that might help create discipline, right? Because if somebody knows you're going to do it, it's a way in which you break the habit. I think it's important for retirees because I find that over time in retirement, when a spouse is then left on their own, meaning somebody passes away, right? Husband passes away, wife passes away. I hate to bring it up, but it happens, right? When you plan, very few people take their last breath together on their last day here on earth. So you want to try to work on habits. And I've found too many widows or widowers who take on their bad spending habits when it's just them and they're going through the emotional anguish of losing their partner. So you might want to consider simple, take a look at it. Hey, and if you have kids that are off to college or in school or working, wouldn't be a bad idea to have them start to put money into their online simple account so that you can watch exactly how the money's being spent in real time. That's different than waiting for the statement to come in or having to go and look online. How many times you said, oh, geez, you know, I just didn't look online at little Johnny's account down at University of Maryland, and holy cow, looks like he bought all the kegs for the party. How would you like to get that ding from the beer distributor 7 o'clock on a Friday night when Johnny's using the simple card? You can always just make the phone call. Tell him to be careful. Make sure you eat before the party starts. Carb up. Just having fun with changing technology and seeing what you think. Tell me what you think. You can email me, steve@cfnplan.com. That's steve@cfnplan.com. Also, you can find me on Facebook, facebook.com/cfnplan. Thanks so much for listening. Make it a great rest of week and weekend, and I look forward to talking to you next week on the Your Life, Your Wealth Network. I'm Steve Cordasco.
Thanks for joining us on the Your Life, Your Wealth Network. All of our shows are reproduced as podcasts and can be listened to on demand at your convenience. If you're interested in learning more about applying the principles we discuss to your personal financial circumstances, please visit Cordasco Financial Network at cfnplan.com or call our office at 215-558-3500. We hope you'll join us again next time on the Your Life, Your Wealth Network.